I was thinking, I'll adjust my thinking a little bit, but I was thinking to speak something from the Bhagavatam that's in relation to something from Bhagavad Gita, and share a little bit how the Bhagavad Gita is basics. What we need to know is in Bhagavad Gita. If we can understand Bhagavad Gita, we have our ticket back to God, and if that's the case, then why do we need anything other? Why Srimad Bhagavatam? So that's the topic. I've been reading consecutively and speaking on verses from the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Kapila Dev's teachings to Devahuti. I'm going to continue with that, but show how it connects with Bhagavad Gita. Not just connects, it's a further expansion of the message of Bhagavad Gita. Persons that are not familiar with Lord Kapila Dev so much, they know a few things. Lord Kapila Dev is an incarnation. Specifically, he's a Shaktivesh avatar. Shaktivesh avatar means one who's bearing, living entity, who is bearing the potency of the Supreme Lord. So, in such completeness that Shaktivesh avatar is none different than the Supreme Lord. So there's these two categories, Jiva and Vishnu. Jiva Tattva, Vishnu Tattva. Incarnations of the Lord commonly are Vishnu Tattva. From the spiritual world, they descend to this material world for some purpose of six different categories. And of those six categories, one of those is this Shaktivesh avatar, some of whom are jivas, like we're jivas. Of course, the guna avatars, for example, Lord Brahma, he's guna avatar, he's presiding over Rajogun for the purpose of creation of this universe. And he's a jiva, and he's in a category of avatar, guna avatar. And then Lord Shiva, he's in charge of the destruction of the universe, and he's in his own category, is Shiva tattva. And then Vishnu, in Vishnu tattva, for the purpose of maintenance of the creation. Those are guna avatars, one category of guna avatars, but another is Shaktivesh avatar, not to spend too much time on this, but that's Lord Kapila Dev. He's in that category. And as a Shaktivesh avatar, he's a certain, there are different subdivisions of Shaktivesh avatars that are described by Rupa Goswami in a very amazing book called Lagu Bhagavatamrita. Won't go into that too much. But he, Kapila Dev, isn't it the special category that's like Dhanvantri, who gave Ayurveda, who's like Dattatreya, who gave very elevated teachings on transcendental knowledge, like Vyasadeva, who wrote the Vedas and certainly gave transcendental teachings. And they're characteristics that commonly they manifest pastimes that are deeply renounced and detached from this world. And they live for a very long time. Chiranjivas, or long, long duration of life. And they give very elevated teachings, especially very elevated teachings. So when people think of Lord Kapila Dev, commonly they think of, they don't know so much, very elevated teachings. So elevated it's way beyond anything that a little me can possibly even think of understanding, because it's so elevated. And there are something like 9 chapters in the third canto discussing Lord Kapiladeva's teachings. And what I'm going to be discussing, you can see, it's not so way elevated that you can't even... But it's taking the teaching that's there in Bhagavad Gita and giving another layer, another higher perspective on these basic teachings. But they resonate completely. The part that's very elevated is the description of the elements, the 24 elements of creation, and how they come into being. That's high science. It's very, very sophisticated technology, spiritual technology. If you wanted to be a creator, how would you do it? Well, this is how Lord Vishnu, even before Lord Brahma appears, he brings into being from the unmanifest state to the manifest state all the elements. Boom, boom, boom. Boom, boom, boom. Cause and effect. And it goes back to the original cause. That's Lord Vishnu. And something on the spiritual side moves, and then matter starts to move, and then subtle matter into grosser matter, and that becomes the next grosser level of matter. And it's very, very amazing. And those who are not devotees, the scholarly impersonalists, they like Sankhya philosophy because they can twist it and turn it and God disappears. Everything comes from, and they can just fill in the blank, and they do. Everything comes from nothing, or everything comes from homogeneous Brahman, undifferentiated smoothie. Okay. And so if you hear this part carefully of Lord Kapiladeva's teachings, you won't get away with the undifferentiated smoothie rendering of, you know, the nirvishesha shunyavad rendering or interpretation. It's not going to happen. You'll see from what the verses that we're going to be discussing. So the verses that I'm going to be reading are Canto 3, Chapter 32, verses 3 through 7. And it's in a section where Kapiladeva is answering a question of Devahuti that goes back 7 chapters. She wants to know how to become free from the materialistic conception of life, because she's feeling now that her husband Kardava Muni has just gone, because now Kapiladeva, having been born according to the prediction of Lord Vishnu and Lord Brahma, an incarnation of the Lord would appear as the son of Kardava Muni and Devahuti. I mean, we have some wonderful children. They're not incarnations of God. Wonderful children. But an incarnation of Lord Vishnu appeared as their son. And when he was of age to maintain and take look after his mother, as was the commitment at the time prior to his marriage, that he would, with Swayambhuva Manu, the father of Devahuti, he would leave his wife, Devahuti, in charge of her son, their son, and go to the forest and continue his Satya Yuga process of spiritual perfection. which he had already attained, but he was showing by example, this is what you do with your life. You complete your worldly responsibilities and you continue on the path of achieving spiritual perfection. Even you've already become perfect, as he had become perfect. Just to set example. Like there's that discussion in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna wants to leave the battlefield. From the outset, he gives all of his reasons, moral reasons, ethical reasons, good sounding reasons, which Krishna gives him an A for, but then gives him an F for applying his principles on the bodily platform instead of on the spiritual platform. And then discusses Sankhya philosophy, the distinction between matter and spirit, chapter 2, first part, Bhagavad Gita. So Arjuna gets the idea that Krishna doesn't want him. In fact, Krishna specifically says, Arjuna, you're saying, if I engage in this battle, then I'll incur sin. Well, the fact of the matter is, Arjuna, if you do not engage in your prescribed duty, you incur sin. Neglect of the performance of prescribed duty will bring a sinful reaction. So you don't have the adhikar, you don't have the qualification for karma sannyas, you have the qualification for karma palatyag, renouncing the fruits of your work. That's your qualification. So do that. So then Arjuna comes up with another idea. Well, what if I attain spiritual perfection? Then can I renounce? Then I'll have the adhikar. And Krishna says, no. Because when you have the adhikar, then you'll do to show by example. This is what you do. Follow? This is what a perfected devotee does. He performs his duties. Because he's showing those that aren't perfect, here's how you do it. He's showing by example. Like checkmate. He wants to wiggle, and there's no wiggle room. Perform your prescribed duty. So now, in chapter 32 of Lord Kapiladeva's teachings, he's just finished describing, in the previous chapter, the movement of the soul, of the living entity, through the course of prior to conception, life in the womb of the mother, what that experience is like from the living entity that's within the womb of the mother, and it's not a very fun picture. And then praying to the Supreme Lord, let me out here. And he comes and forgets everything because of all the reasons that are given. And then in babyhood and boyhood and, fast forwards into a conclusion that is the punchline of the whole previous chapter. So I read it this morning, I'll read it again now. Therefore, all of the whole previous chapter is to make this point. Therefore, one should not view death with horror, nor have recourse to defining the body as soul, nor give way to exaggeration in enjoying the bodily necessities of life, realizing the true nature of the living entity, that's the soul. One should move about the world free from attachment and steadfast in purpose. Be transcendental to the temporal and be situated in the eternal. Krishna says that in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Nasate vijate bhavo na bhavo vijate sataha. Ubayor api drishton tvastvanios tattva darshibhi. So the whole chapter to expand that one verse of Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna's advice to Arjuna is the tattva darshis, the seers of the truth, they don't place much value in asat. They place value in sat. How about you turn it off? Fantastic, thank you. Okay. So that's the conclusion of the previous chapter. So now the movement of the living entity has come to the stage where chapter 32 begins, and now that wonderful event of marriage and family life. How wonderful. So he, Kapiladev, in response to Devahuti's question about how do we come free from involvement in materialistic life, she doesn't have materialistic life. She has a completely elevated life. But she's speaking that way. Kapiladev thinks, our Acharya commentators say, he smiles, thinking, Devahuti, why are you talking like this? You're my mother. And I'm the personality of Godhead. You can't have this way of thinking. I know you don't have that. I'm situated in your heart, and I'm your son. I know very well how your thinking is. But you're speaking this way for the benefit of others. So I'll give an answer for the benefit of others, just to please you. So he speaks seven chapters to please his mother. Specifically, the very last verse of the previous chapter. Endowed with right vision and strengthened by devotional service and with a pessimistic attitude towards material identity, not, you know, doing things of this world, but identifying on the material platform with those things. One should relegate his body to this illusory world through his reason, because my real identity is spirit, soul, and I live that way. I'm doing things with the body, but that's not who I am. And the next chapter is he's making a distinction between a life in family life, very relevant to many persons here, a life in family life where there's attachment to the Supreme, and life in family life where there's attachment to material identity. And one leads to one result, another leads to another result. One leads to one kind of consciousness, another leads to another kind of consciousness. And with them, different results. So, like Krishna does in the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where he promises Arjuna, I'm going to describe something more confidential than anything else I've said before. It's so confidential I can say it out loud and very clearly and still people aren't going to understand. That kind of confidential. It's not, don't tell anybody, Arjun. It's the other kind. And that most confidential is, what is the intimate relationship of love between the soul and the Supreme Soul when they're connected in that loving relation. To do that, Krishna says what it is, as well he says what it isn't. Because some people have an idea that, oh, that's what it is, but that's not what it is. So Krishna makes it very clear, that's what it isn't, and that's what it is. That's a good definition, that's both inclusive and exclusive. So, as Krishna does that in the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Kapiladeva is doing the same for Devahuti. She wants to know how to get out of this bondage because of materialistic life. Because my mind is polluted. I can't think of the spiritual reality because my mind is so polluted due to attachment. And I can't get out because this is your energy. You're the Supreme Lord. And it's by your energy you've put me in this situation so you can take me out of this situation. Please remove that potency and give me the other one, the reality potency, the internal potency, instead of this deluding potency. Please. Be merciful. So, to make sure that Devahuti and the rest of us who Devahuti is asking on behalf of, to be sure that we can understand what spiritual reality is, or in this particular chapter, what spiritual household life is, in contrast with what it isn't, he explains what it isn't. Or what is household life that's attached to the material identity of self. I'm this body. I'm the coverings of the soul. In fact, I don't even think so much about the soul. Or I may be very pious and have some idea of the soul, and it really doesn't match what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, but that's okay. I have a conception of the soul because pious people have a conception of the soul. I'll explain, give an example. I remember in the year 2000, they did many surveys. And one of those surveys was, how many people in America in the year 2000 believe in the soul? How many of them believe in life after this life? The soul goes on, and that's who we are. The percentages were huge. Something, believe in the soul was something close to 90% or 91% or something like that. Believe in the soul. And life after death wasn't so much lower. It was in, you know, upper 80s. Really? Now, how many people live their life that way? Because that's a pious thing to believe in, the soul. But try it sometime. I've tried it sometimes. Ask people from different backgrounds, what is your conception of the soul? And it's a riot how many different conceptions of the soul there are. You want to hear what a cardinal in the Roman Catholic Church, Cardinal Danielio, believes what the soul is? Cardinal. Not a bishop, a priest, a cardinal. It's the capacity to reason. And animals don't have soul because they don't have the capacity to reason. And Prabhupada said to Cardinal Daniel, where's that in the Bible? And he didn't give an answer to his question. He just went on with, you know, why he believes that way. Some believe that there's animal souls, and there's human souls, and there's plant souls, and there's bird souls. And that's it. If you got a human body, that's, you're a human soul, and next life is going to be human life. And if you're a bird, then you're going to be a bird, because you're a bird soul. I can go on. There are Jewish souls, and there's everybody else. The everybody else is called Goyim. So you can become a Jew by practice and faith, but you're still Goyim. And then there's Jews. There's chosen. The chosen ones. It's in the Old Testament. That's our faith in the Old Testament. There's chosen souls. That's the Jews. And then there's everybody else. These two kinds of souls. And so on and so on and so on. I mean, one with a Christian was, you know, there was some discussion, do you believe in reincarnation? They were asking me, do you believe in reincarnation? And I said, not only we do, but so do you. At least it's in the Bible. I said, oh, no, it's not in the Bible. I gave them examples of where it's in the Bible. And their response was, And I said, so, when I was a boy, the Bible said, thou shalt not kill. And then I went to college, and when I was finished with college, it was different. It was, thou shalt not murder. Something happened between when I was a kid and when I was an adult. What happened? Somebody edited something just within a short period of time. What to speak of all that other period of time, like the Council of Nicaea, where they edited out a whole bunch of stuff about reincarnation. Under the order of King Constantine, the bishops got together, and they were told not to leave until they did that, because he didn't like it. So they did it. They just took it out of the Bible. But some things are still there. Anyway, without going into biblical study. So they said, no, animals don't have a soul. Said, what's your reasoning? Because the soul is there where you have eternal life and animals don't have eternal life. Because you can only have eternal life if you accept Christ as your Savior. The animals can't do that. So there's no soul. I said, wow. Does that mean, you know, the implication of what you're saying is, if I don't say those words, I accept Christ as my Savior, I also don't have a soul, and I'm subject to being food on your table. Because I don't have a soul. So it's equally applicable, right? Hmm? And how about this one? You know, the souls are eternal, right? Yes. Okay, so before you uttered those words, you weren't a soul, but then you became a soul. So you, for eternally going that direction, you're a soul. But what about that direction? In time. Hmm? Etc. So 90-something percent of the people in America in the year 2000 accepted that there's a soul. But what do they accept? It's a cartoon show of what some persons accept. Because they haven't had the opportunity to hear very clearly the descending, undistorted message of transcendental knowledge. So Kapila Dev is giving that to Devahuti. She's already qualified. But through her, the fit recipient, he's giving so that we can also receive. Okay. So now I'm going to read some of the... So he starts with the first verse, first couple verses. We covered those this morning. From when the soul that's been through so many stages of before conception in the womb of the mother and now born, now growing up and becoming attached, becomes attached in family life. So he makes a compare contrast between attached to the material conception of life and in family life attached to the progressive path of self-realization. And they're like night and day different. Although they may look the same by immature evaluation, by mature evaluation, it's as different as night and day. And the principles are described. Now I'm going to read a few verses, and the point that I want to make especially is how the message of Lord Kapila Dev is not something impersonal, it's something personal. The Absolute Supreme is a person. And the message of Lord Kapila Dev is the same message of Krishna and Bhagavad Gita. Just a further, you know, the graduate level of the undergraduate study. That comparison has been given. Bhagavad Gita is undergraduate, Bhagavatam is graduate study. So in undergraduate study, or in elementary math, 2 plus 2 is 4. In advanced math, 2 plus 2 is 4. It doesn't become something else. Just the way that that's applied may be more sophisticated, but the elements are the same. So, text number 3, speaking about the attached person attached to the material conception, material identity of self. Such materialistic persons attached to sense gratification and devoted to worship of the forefathers and demigods can be elevated to the moon, where they drink an extract of the soma plant. What was his name, the astronaut that went to the moon? Armstrong? Neil Armstrong? I wonder if he saw any soma plants. The Bhagavatam speaks about it. And the Bhagavad Gita speaks about it. Let me show you some of the places where Bhagavad Gita speaks about it. Chapter 2, Bhagavad Gita, text 43, 42 and 43 in the translation here. Men of small knowledge are very much attached to the flowery words of the Vedas, which recommend various fruitive activities for elevation to heavenly planets, result in good birth, power, and so forth. Being desirous of sense gratification and opulent life, they say, there is nothing more than this. Vedavadarata is the phrase. There is nothing more than this. And in the purport, Prabhupada writes, in the Karmakanda section of the Vedas, it is said, gives a long Sanskrit, about observing Chaturmasya in a specific way. As we also observe Chaturmasya and Ekadasis and things in a certain way, those who perform the four-month penances become eligible to drink somarasa beverages to become immortal and happy forever. Even on this earth, some are very eager to have somarasa to become strong and fit to enjoy sense gratifications. Such persons have no faith in liberation from material bondage, and they are very much attached to the pompous ceremonies of Vedic sacrifices. They are generally sensual, and they do not want anything other than heavenly pleasures of life. It is understood that there are gardens called the Nandana Kanana, in which there is good opportunity for association with angelic, beautiful women, and having a profuse supply of soma rasa, wine. Such bodily happiness is certainly sensual, therefore there are those who are purely attached to such material temporary happiness as lords of the material world. It's specifically mentioned in the 8th chapter of Bhagavad Gita also. Chapter Bhagavad Gita. Text 20. Those who study the Vedas and drink the soma rasa, seeking the heavenly planets, worship me indirectly. Soma. Where is it? Soma pa. Drinkers of soma juice, soma rasa. Purified of sinful reactions, they take birth on the pious heavenly planets of Indra, where they enjoy godly delights. So, Kapiladeva is also speaking of the same attraction for, we discussed it this morning, where there's not just a weak, but it's absent, and there's no desire for that which is eternal. It's desiring the Ferris wheel, where I'm in this position and I want to go up, 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 and enjoy it. And then after Kshinye Punye Marcha Loka Mishanti, after in the 8th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, after exhausting those pious activities, boop, 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 and then come back again and do it again. Without any thought of the eternal soul and the position of ultimate happiness, as Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita. So it's described in the purport that the duration of life in those heavenly planets is for 10,000 celestial years. That's a long duration of life. But the celestial year is not like one of our years. Rather, 6 months here is equal to 1 day there. And 1 night there is another 6 months. So 1 year here is 1 day there. So 10,000 of those years. That's a long duration to enjoy heavenly pleasure. But, and that's described in the 8th chapter, after those 10,000 years, celestial heavenly years. So persons, the Vedic formulas give that, and Kapila Deva is saying, persons, there are some persons that are attracted to that. They want. And they follow the rituals and the procedures and the austerities and the everything, sacrifices, that can get them that. Because that's what they desire. And that's all they desire. That sensual pleasure. One has to be extremely pious to attain those heavenly realms. But so there's a path to achieve that. He goes on, text 4. All the planets of the materialistic persons, including all the heavenly planets, such as the moon, are vanquished when the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, goes to his bed of the serpents, which is known as Anantashesh. What does that mean? Prabhupada explains there are two annihilations, major ones. One is the total annihilation, and the other is a partial annihilation. And the partial annihilation takes place at the end of Brahma's day. At the end of Brahma's day, he takes rest. And while he's taking rest, there's a partial annihilation that is, it's described in this way. There is a 10,000 year drought, no rain. And then following rain, there's a little fire at the bottom of the universe from the mouth of Anantashesh. Fire comes and everything just bursts into flames. And the flames are so intense that the Bhuvar and Svarga Loka realms are burned. They become ashes. And above those three, there's Maharloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka, and Brahmaloka. There's another four, because there's seven upper, seven lower. So the seven lower are burned, and the three, the one, including the heavenly planets, become ashes at the end of Brahma's day. And those upper planetary regions, they're so hot. Maharloka residents, they get in their vimanas and they go to the Tapaloka realm for the night of Brahma. And the Tapaloka vasis, they welcome them, they stay for some time. And then afterward they come back because they like Maharloka. They like the yajnas that they do in Maharloka. They're grihasthas, sense-controlled grihasthas, it's described in Brihad Bhagavatamrita. And then at the end of Brahma's night comes Brahma's morning. He does his sadhana. And then he recreates those planets that were dissolved. Oh, because after their ashes, then there's a flood. That's similarly described in other scriptures, like the Bible, the big flood. And all the animals are put on Noah's Ark and off he goes to preserve, you know, one of each kind, male, female. And at the end of the flood, then they populate again. Doesn't say what happens in between, but at the end they populate again. So the Vedic picture is there's a flood. And so after it puts out the fire. And it's the Garbhadak Ocean. And it, everything gets submerged in the Garbhadak Ocean. And then the before Brahma can recreate that portion of the universe that was destroyed, the elements have to again be manifest. That's what Lord Vishnu does. What Kapila Dev describes in earlier chapters. He manifests the elements again. He has a big warehouse. And he can have, all the things that he needs to put the creation together again in their elemental stage. And then there's a total annihilation that's being described in this verse, and that's at the end of Brahma's life. 100 years of those of days of Brahma, at the end, Ananta, the Supreme Lord, Mahavishnu, he inhales, and all the of the creation enters in its primordial or avyakta, unmanifest state within his body. That's what's being described here. So, whether you're on the heavenly planets or all the way up to the topmost Brahmaloka, that's also dissolved at the end of Brahma's day. Brahma's body, Brahma's planet, the whole show, the whole cosmos. It's gone. So his point is, Kapila's point to Devahuti is, it's aspiring for that which is temporary, those who are on that path of piety, of karmakanda yajnas and so on, it's dissolved. It's temporary. Whatever it is that's attained, it's taken. Prabhupada likens it something like a child building a sandcastle at the edge of the ocean. You know, a big, big effort, beautiful sandcastle, the tide comes in and washes the whole thing away. Like that, the however long the duration of life, 10,000 celestial years, the creation is much longer than that. After that, Krishna says in the 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, text 21, one again descends to this earthly plane and starts building their pious credits again. So again, after this life, if they continue a life of piety, they could continue to go further down also. Otherwise, it's the Ferris wheel. Up, 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 down, 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 up, 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 down, 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 and then dissolved. So it's not he, Kapila Dev, is advising Devahuti. The model, we were using this term this morning, the model of material prosperity has some very serious holes. It's, by design, it's flawed. So then, he goes to the other side. This is what we're supposed to do and, hear and follow. Those who are intelligent and are of purified consciousness are completely satisfied in Krishna consciousness. That's his translation of buddhi. Freed from all modes of material nature, they do not act for sense gratification. Rather, since they are situated in their own occupational duties, they act as one is expected to act. Now he's describing householders, not sannyasi sadhus. Householders who are situated in household duties, executing their responsible duties of life, they do their responsible duties of life. Even they know their real identity is spirit soul. They're accepting that position to carry out what their God-given nature is according to their psychology and their embodiment. Their psychophysical nature is there, and it's impelling. Naturally so. One is inclined this, and one is inclined that, and it's natural because of the embodied state. So accepting that embodied state, natural position, those duties are under the codes of the Vedas and done with without attachment to let me enjoy sense gratification through this, but rather let the Supreme Lord be pleased by this offering unto Him. Different consciousness, totally different consciousness. That's one whose goal of life is self-realization or God-realization. But even just say self-realization, because self-realization and God-realization, they occur simultaneously. You don't have one without the other. You don't have God-realization without self-realization. You don't have self-realization. What's self-realization without God-realization? Because the self is in relation to the Supreme. How can I realize myself separate from the Supreme? That's not what self-realization is. It includes God-realization. What's my relationship with the Supreme? Who is He? If the light's not on, I'm not going to see myself. What to speak of the source of light? In the purport, Prabhupada discusses Arjuna. He says he's the first class example of this grihastha, or this in pursuit of self-realization. It's expressed very nicely, so I'm just going to read. Arjuna was a Kshatriya, and his occupational duty was to fight. Generally, kings fight to extend their kingdoms, which they rule for sense gratification. As far as Arjuna is concerned, he declined to fight for his own sense gratification. He said that although he could get a kingdom by fighting, he did not want to fight with them. But when he was ordered by Krishna and convinced by the teachings of Bhagavad Gita that his duty was to satisfy Krishna, then he fought. Thus he fought not for his sense gratification, but for the satisfaction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, in the Mahabharata, it's a major, major topic to understand what is one's duty in life. You know, the struggle of good versus evil, or as we were reading in the Chicago Temple, discussion about Narada speaking to a king, King Prajinibari, without all that detail, Prabhupada's comment is, consciousness is always being pulled in two different directions, what is right and what is wrong. And how do we decide what's right and stay on the path of what's right instead of getting, we know what's right, but we don't do it because of weakness of heart? Or we get pulled in the other direction too strongly by some association or some of the modes of nature or our past karma, and the next thing you know, we're in the ditch. What happened? So how does one stay fixed in proper discrimination and staying on the proper path? It's an issue that's discussed in Mahabharata. What is one's prescribed duty? So the fixed person on the path of self-realization, they accept their nature, they engage themselves according to their nature, under guidance, and they dedicate everything to the Supreme. Persons who work at their prescribed duties not for sense gratification but for the gratification of the Supreme Lord are called nit-sangha, or free from the influence of the modes of nature. No association with the modes of nature. So if you're not impelled by the modes of nature, then what are you impelled by if you're embodied? And you're a grihastha, not impelled by the modes of nature. The body is there, and there are forces that are acting, but they're not acting on you. So what's causing you to act? Dedication to the Supreme. Dedication to Krishna. Attachment to Krishna. And how do you get attachment to Krishna? Kapila Dev said to Devahuti, by attachment to sadhu, you get develop attachment to sat. Krishna. By attachment to those who are attached to the Supreme, you become attached to the Supreme. It's really simple. If you grab a hold of an electric wire that's plugged into the socket, you get a shock. Because the electric wire that's connected to the socket and that switches on, you paid your electric bill. You're getting electricity. You're not going to the power plant, Con Ed or whatever it is, power plant, and, you know, grabbing a hold of the thing. You're way over here. Because it's connected, you get electricity. Even if it's remote, you're connected to the source of power. So by connecting to sadhu, you become connected to Krishna. That's what Devahuti is hearing from Kapiladeva. And such persons who are recipients of that sadhu sangha, they're not disturbed by the modes of nature. The modes of nature is like a storm. Krishna gives this example. The lotus that's above the surface of the water, and then there's a storm. The waves are rising and falling, and the lotus is undisturbed, not getting wet, because it's above the surface of the water, even there's a storm. Similarly, one who has taken shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is transcendental to the modes of nature, not influenced. So that's what he's saying. The grihastha who is attached to sadhu sangha is not attached to the modes of nature. They're not influenced by the modes of nature. Although they're acting, we're still in the material world. The soul is still here. It's not influencing the fixed grihastha. And then another term is nyastakarmanaha. Their past fruitive activities are not, the fruits of them are not acting. That's a big relief. Such devotees are called prashanta, which means completely satisfied. Shuddha chetasa. Shuddha chetasa. Their consciousness is pure. Prabhupada has translated that as Krishna consciousness. Shuddha chetasa. Because of attachment to transcendence, attachment to sadhu, attachment to the object of sadhu's attachment, the Supreme. Shuddha chetasa. They're sheltered. So even the storm is blowing. They're not moved. In unpurified consciousness, one thinks of himself as the Lord of this universe. But in purified consciousness, one thinks of himself as the eternal servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Putting oneself in that position of eternal servitorship to the Supreme Lord and working for Him perpetually, one actually becomes completely satisfied. Two more. And just to see how this parallels or it's an expansion of the message of Bhagavad Gita. Kapiladeva says, by executing one's occupational duties, acting with detachment, and without a sense of proprietorship of false egoism, practically a restatement of Krishna's verses in Bhagavad Gita, one is posted in one's constitutional position by dint of complete purification of consciousness, and thus, by executing the so-called material duties, he can easily enter into the kingdom of God. Very common, too much common, is the idea that if you get spiritual, you have to renounce the world. It's not just people in India where parents get really nervous when their children, even their adults now, and they start really seriously following Krishna consciousness. Oh no. And their message is, don't be fanatical. You can be religious, but don't be too religious. Don't be fanatical. Because, you know, the thought is, then you'll just renounce your family and your duties, and you'll become, you know, irresponsible. So don't be fanatical. Don't get too serious. But it's a misconception. It's a Shankara teaching. I had this experience. I was traveling once from Delhi to Hyderabad, and they were remodeling the Delhi airport, So the lines were ridiculously long. The check-in line took a half an hour just to check your bag. And then security, another half an hour. Good thing I was early. And, you know, there are five lines that were like, you know, so long, football field long. And there was a person that was ahead of me in the other line, and he kept looking back. Like, you know, I was some kind of freak or something. And he kept looking back and looking back. And finally, I got on the other side of security and looked for a place. And he had saved me a seat. I sat. And he said, come sit next to me. And, okay. And he said, you know, the usual things. Are you part of a spiritual organization? So, yes. And I have some questions. How long have you been doing this? So many years. Oh, I have a question. Do I have to give up my family life in order to be a spiritual person? I said, where'd you hear that? He said, Sringeri Math. I was told that you forget it. If you want to advance in spiritual life as a grihastha, don't even try because you can't. You have to renounce your family life in order to begin to make spiritual progress. He said, that's not what Krishna says to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna wants to do that. And Krishna says, no. Don't do that. And just as I was having this, you know, explaining that teaching to him, through security came two devotees with their son, and they had tilak on, bead bag, and their son came right over and paid obeisances, and they paid obeisances. We were sitting down and said, see, there's an example. There's grihasthas who are practicing Krishna consciousness, and they're making very, very genuine spiritual progress. I said, just ask them any question you like and hear what their message is, and you'll see for yourself. I knew the devotee couple, you know, they're very nicely trained in Krishna consciousness. So I tell you what, I'll get up and chant japa a bit. You can sit down and you have some conversation and you see if they're spiritually advanced or not. And they'll explain to you how to do that. We're very fortunate. I mean, how to say very fortunate? How many very, 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 very fortunate? Times 10. Because, you know, we'd have to go through that stand on your head and jump up and down program to try to get spiritual advancement out of life. The principles are very clear, and if heard properly and applied properly, one can make spiritual advancement. And here's Kapiladev, a renunciate, explaining about proper household life in contrast to attached, materially covered conceptions of life going, you know, very quickly in the wrong direction. How to go nicely in the right direction. He doesn't say, as Krishna doesn't say to Arjuna, give up your duties, stop being a householder and go become renounced. Shankaracharya may have said that, but Krishna didn't say that and Kapiladev didn't say that. So, here's what Kapila says. Stay in your situation, just as Lord Brahma. Stane statak shutigatam tanavan manobhir. Stay in your position. And hear the topics of Krishna from whatever your position is. Yane prayasam udapasya namanta eva. Give up the inclination to speculate, to understand things, and just hear from proper sources. And in that position, whatever your position is, you will spiritually become elevated to the point where you'll go back to Godhead. You'll inherit, like the son inherits the property of the father, you'll inherit the property of the father, the supreme father, and that's the kingdom of God. That's the message. You achieve the spiritual world. Just stay in your position, whatever that is. Don't do those things for sense gratification. Do those things for satisfaction of the senses of the Supreme. Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam. Very simple. Simple in principle. The application part is a little difficult because we're so inclined to sense gratification and mental speculation. Last verse. Through the path of illumination, such liberated persons approach the complete personality of Godhead, who is the proprietor of the material and spiritual worlds and is the supreme cause of their manifestation and dissolution. So, does anybody recall that same language in Bhagavad Gita of the path of illumination? The path of illumination. It's in chapter 8 of Bhagavad Gita where it describes the yogi. First, Krishna talks about just being Krishna conscious, and you'll go to him. And then there's the yogi. I'll read. The yogi. Those who know the Supreme Brahman attain the Supreme by passing away from the world during the influence of the fiery God in the light at an auspicious moment of the day, during the fortnight of the waxing moon, or during the 6 months when the sun travels in the north. The mystic who passes away from this world during the smoke, the night, the fortnight of the waning moon, or the 6 months when the sun passes to the south, reaches the moon planet. But again, comes back. That's the mystic. The one who's not attached to the Supreme in devotion, but has worked very hard to become detached from matter and has some faith in something that's beyond this realm. So, the path of the sun. Surya Dvarena. Surya is the sun. Dvarena. The gateway. The path of illumination. When the sun is moving in the north. So that's what we're in that period now. Vakra Sankranti marks when the sun starts moving in the northerly direction. And the days become longer and the nights become shorter, and because at least in the northern hemisphere, the sun is moving in the northerly direction. When, in one of the later chapters of the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, Krishna and Arjuna follow that path. You know that story? There's a Brahmin in Dwarka whose sons, they don't die. They just disappear. One after the next. They're born and they just disappear. So the Brahmin becomes very unhappy. And he starts speaking not nice things about Krishna. Even if you're Krishna, it happens. So what to speak of us? What kind of leader is Krishna? Ugrasena is the king, but Krishna's in the ruling dynasty. And look at this, a qualified Brahmana, and my children just disappear. What kind of protection is this by the Kshatriya? So Arjuna happened to be visiting when he was going off like that. And Arjuna heard this, and he went right to the Brahmana. He heard the Brahmana speaking this way. He went to the Brahmana and said, I'm Krishna's devotee, and I give you my promise that your next child that's born will be safe. I will personally see to it. You just let me know. I'll come and see to it. I'll protect you. And if it fails, then I'll give up my life. I take that vow before you now. Okay. So before, just before the child was to be born, he called Arjuna, by mystic power with his arrows, he made a house to protect around the house of the Brahmana so that nothing and nobody could enter. And sure enough, when the child was born, the child disappeared. And the Brahmana was really unhappy, and Arjuna was, I'll find your child. He looked throughout the whole of creation and he couldn't find the child. So then I have to keep my vow. So he set a funeral pyre, a big pile of wood, and was about to enter into the fire, and Krishna stopped and said, Arjuna, what are you doing? I took a vow. Well, I know where the sun is. Oh, let's go. Dwarka, get my chariot, let's go. So Dwarka got his chariot, and Krishna and Arjuna went on the chariot, and they followed the path of the sun. And many other things are described. They went through the coverings of the universe. That must have been amazing. And then on the other side of the universe, this glaring, brilliant jyoti. And then they went to the abode of Mahavishnu, which is beyond this universe. And when they went to the abode of Mahavishnu, Mahavishnu was so happy. He said, I did it. I took all the children. Because I'm so busy serving you, I don't get a chance to see you, so I took the children, because I knew that you would come to rescue them. Here are the children. You could take them back to the Brahmin. Not only Krishna knows about the path of the sun, he created it. And so it's described that even to attain the abode of Mahavishnu, Krishna followed that path with Arjuna. And this verse by Kapiladeva is saying there are mystics who they want the association of the Supreme. They have control of their senses. They live their lives in a proper way. And by, just like Bhishmadev is not an ordinary person by any means. In so many ways, he's not an ordinary person. Krishna's showing the very special position of Bhishmadev. By Bhishmadev being able to pacify Yudhisthira, even he couldn't pacify Yudhisthira. Bhishmadev is better than me. Krishna was doing like that. Krishna made it possible for Bhishmadev to do that, but because he's such a devotee. But Bhishmadev, because he had this benediction from his father, that he decided to give up his body when the sun started moving in the northerly direction, the path of the sun. Then he stopped his Bhagavatam class and started withdrawing his senses and fixing his mind upon the personality of Godhead exclusively, and left his body like that. And one, according to what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, one who does that, for sure, he attains me. That's Bhishmadev. See, even Bhishmadev followed that principle, although he need not have followed that principle because he's such an elevated personality. But to show by example for persons who have such interest in mystical things, he did that. He didn't have to do that. He did that for their benefit. To show by example. So, summary. Kapiladeva's teachings, primarily they're understood as Sankhya, but then how do you apply Sankhya? Because it's a philosophy, and how do you apply philosophy? Here is being described in detail, a whole chapter worth of explaining to Devahuti what not to do, what to do. If you're a spirit soul, that's all of us, that have a situation of life where family life is that position that you find yourself. How to do that where it's the path of self-realization, as opposed to the path of the Ferris wheel and continued entanglement. Even the pious kind, and quite often the piety is mixed just because we're in this material world, things, everything becomes contaminated. what to speak of, where you slip on the slippery slope and you find yourself not doing pious activities anymore, but doing the other kind. Just because it's the nature of the place, it's very contaminating. Surcharged with opposition, Prabhupada speaks or writes. So what's that? What's the? We're not qualified like Devahuti, but she's asking for our benefit how to live your life. Wonderful instructions, very practical instructions. And what's the objective? What's the goal? What's the supreme? It's the personality of Godhead, not the other kind, demigod worship or impersonal conception. It's the supreme person, and all things are from him, are to be reposed unto him as offerings and devotion. Stay in your situation, hear the glories of the personality of Godhead, chant his holy name, dedicate your activities in a prescribed manner to him. And the soul, the consciousness becomes fixed upon him. The destination of the soul is him. It's not a surprise Kapila's message is the same as Krishna's message, because same person, just a different expansion of Krishna, one of the avatars of Krishna or Vishnu. Same message, just in a very expanded way. Same message. Okay. Any comments or questions? Yeah.
In the Bhagavad Gita, and you mentioned also that Arjuna's nature was such that Krishna advised him, don't go to the forest, give up everything, but you should perform your duty still. I just heard earlier today from somebody that the difference between Buddha Yoga and Bhakti Yoga is that in Buddha Yoga, the person, they're not attached to the fruits, but they still maybe are attached to the duty or the work itself.
Wow, where'd you hear that? I've not heard such a distinction. As you know, Prabhupada uses them interchangeably, Buddha Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, because Krishna says, Dadami Buddha Yogam Tam Yena Mamu Piyanti Te. And who gets that Buddhi from Krishna? Te Sham Satata Yuktanam Bhajatam Bhajata Ruwarda Bhakti. Priti Purva Kam with love. Completely. Priti Purva Kam Bhajate Yomam. So then Krishna gives buddhi. What kind of? Yena mamu piyantite. How to get to Krishna. How to lead your life and make the decisions in your life in such a way it will lead you to Krishna. Krishna gives that intelligence to such persons who have bhakti. Bhajate yomam. So this distinction between Bodhi Yoga and Bhakti Yoga, there may be a scriptural reference that I'm not familiar with, but I'm not familiar with it, so it's a little difficult to discuss that. If you could find out where is the reference, I'd appreciate hearing, then we could have some discussion. As far as my understanding is, buddhi is an emphasis upon a specific thing, a specific component of bhakti or aspect of bhakti, where Krishna has given one a very select kind of intelligence. How to come to him. That's what buddhi is in the context of bhakti. And bhakti is one who is engaging, as he says in the 12th chapter, mind fully upon me, intelligence always absorbed in me. And if you can't do that, then there's regulation so you can get that. So we're doing sadhana bhakti, but following the vidhis, the regulations of bhakti. But bhakti is that. Intelligence fixed upon me. That's the buddhi component of bhakti. That's 12th chapter Bhagavad Gita. So I don't know what this other reference is. Something else? Going once. Okay. So let us have kirtan.